You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to talk about today several different things. We have our normal segments of Success Through Action Worldview, and we're going to talk a little bit about food preservation. And this is going to be at least a two-part series. We'll see where we end up with that. But for today specifically, we're going to talk about canning, water bath and pressure canning, and all of that. All right. So, you know what? Why don't we just do a quick update, because it's been a while. I mean, we've only put out a few podcasts over the last...
several months.
Yeah. 2 to 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, it's because we've been very busy. And now the season is kind of winding down. I mean, of course, we're still busy. We've got a lot of projects going on. But
we're
some
less
of those
busy with the teaching and
yes.
the workshops.
We managed to teach 9 different workshops over the last several months. That was good.
Yeah.
It was a good, great experience. And we've got good feedback.
Yeah.
And you know, we're looking forward to doing more next year. But some exciting developments. How about, let's talk real quick about courses online. We're getting ready to push some courses online.
Yeah, so this week is going to be kind of the week that we really push forward on recording those online courses and make them available then to a larger audience
of people.
Yeah, so
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So we're not going to talk about which ones we're launching first because, well... don't know fully. Yeah. We know one or two of them, but
and as we get them done, we'll go ahead
sure.
and announce that and let people know how to go about getting those courses.
Absolutely, and also okay, around the homestead here, we've been doing a lot of animal processing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're shrinking down, you know, our winter livestock because of course it costs more money to feed livestock over the winter. Plus, it's just that time of the year where we need to fill our freezer. And fill our jars.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
With
in this
with
case, meat.
And,
yeah.
And
broth.
Yeah.
Broths. And
absolutely. So that's, of course, a big development. So we've been doing a lot of that. Another little venture that we've undertaken is we're now processing birds for customers.
Mm-hmm.
So another farmstead venture is bird processing. So chickens and ducks and turkeys and even geese, which was a nightmare.
It was a nightmare.
But anyway, so a little side venture, nothing major, no. And in fact, we will stay under 1,000 birds a year. That's where that triggers a lot of regulations and rules, et cetera, that we're not set up, nor are we
trying.
Wanting to scale up to that.
Yeah.
To that level. It doesn't mean we don't have a good process. We have a clean outdoor station, and we are doing it well, and customers are happy.
Well, yeah, and we have repeat customers, so.
That's right. So they obviously didn't die.
No.
Okay, so let's talk about success through action. And there's something that we encounter a lot, and it admittedly, totally, you know, truth in advertising here, is when you know, how to get back on track once you get off track.
Right. Yeah. Not getting bogged down by the, I can't believe I'm not actually doing what I said I was going to do.
Yes.
And just that's where I am right now, and let's get moving back where we want to be.
Right. So, of course, that happens to us every now and again.
Yeah. Because, I mean, life happens, and visitors come, and they put you off schedule, major life changes or whatever it may be can very easily get you off.
Right. So then all of a sudden your routine, your goals, your daily list, making lists, to-do lists, planning, getting things on the calendar. A lot of times those things can drop off really easily.
Yep.
And it's important not to get discouraged by that, but to just jump back in the game.
Right. Don't say, oh, see, I'll never do it. It doesn't matter. You're going to mess up and you're going to get off track, but you just get back on and you keep doing that. And those gaps or that time where you're off track will get less and less. It will decrease over time and you'll be on track more often. and still maintaining a positive attitude about yourself.
Right. Just like, oh, we're terrible. We suck.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, one technique to do that for people out there, you get off track and you want to get back on track, but you're discouraged, is to, you know, instead of getting entirely back into your routine or everything else, start with where you are and do what you can. So a technique would be to set a few reasonable weekly goals, even daily if you have to. It's like, okay, the most I can do is just set a few goals for today.
Right.
Fine, do it. But weekly, you know, we recommend setting out some weekly goals and then being diligent and get back on track, meet those goals. And then after you have that kind of success, it's going to be easier to get back on your full routine. Reviewing your major goals every day.
Right. Your morning routine, your evening routine.
Right.
Following your to-do lists and
right.
and do backward planning. It can be overwhelming if you're not doing any of that anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so don't try and re-implement every single thing. Just start with, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to set some weekly goals.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's, okay, I can't even do that right now. I'm just going to set a couple of daily goals today. I'm going to make a to-do list, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that would be our recommendation. And we say this from experience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we get off track every now and again. But we don't let that keep us down, and we work hard to get back on track.
Right. And having those successes builds your self-confidence and helps you know that I can do a little bit more tomorrow.
That's right. So
next week,
you want to regain the momentum.
Right.
Very good. Okay, so let's transition now to a worldview segment. And we talked a lot over the last several podcasts, of course, it's now several months, about some isms.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about socialism and communism and secular humanism and all of that. Now, for today's worldview segment, we wanted to just briefly discuss where we thought America stands
mm-hmm.
with regards to a lot of these isms. And of course, there's no clean cut answer.
No.
You can't say, well, you know, America is secular humanist, and that's not the whole story. Of course, that is a huge part of America.
Mm-hmm.
America is highly secular, and there's a lot of humanism, of course. But we want to try and put together at least a picture of some of these elements that we see throughout the United States and the culture. And of course, there's elements of everything we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
from fascism to communism, to socialism to humanism.
Yeah, and
all of those elements are embedded in the culture.
Right, and those are more political. But then you also are dealing with the secular humanism, which brings you almost into a religious realm. Man is God; it set himself up as God, and that very easily lends itself to what we call spiritualism. There's a lot of spiritualism going on, just not very much Christianity going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, there's a pretty big differentiation between humanism and spiritualism.
Yes.
So humanism, by definition, would deny the supernatural. But by denying the supernatural, they're making themselves
really God.
Yeah. Or they set up the state as God.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be statist or statism.
Right.
And then we have all these elements. You know, our monetary system is filled with socialism.
Yes.
And we have a two-party system where both sides of the aisle are socialist.
They are.
Okay. Sorry to say that to all the Republicans out there who are still holding fast to their
Republicanism.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but most Republicans are no longer actually holding those ideals.
Right.
Or those principles at all. And in fact, they promote and engage in many, many, many socialist programs. And it's only getting worse with regards to our monetary system.
Well, yeah. I think at this point, both of our parties are sort of synonymous. There's no real
differentiation. We can sit here and argue about, you know,
maybe
semantics,
right.
the degree
right.
of embracing socialism or humanism or whatever else. Sure. Yeah. The leftists are a little bit more, you know, they're They're open with their socialism.
Right.
That'll be the difference.
Yeah, they'll claim it.
They'll claim it. We are actually getting to the point where socialism is no longer a dirty word, and they will openly promote it.
Right.
Now, many on as far as leftists are concerned, will still not use that term. And in the right side, all the Republicans, of course, will never use that term. That is a dirty word still in the Republican Party, even though they engage in socialism.
Right.
Okay, so we're mincing words. We're changing definitions. But that's the reality of our system. And it's important as Christians that we look at these things through a Christian worldview.
Right.
Christianity is not steeped in socialism at all.
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of personal responsibility, and when Jesus directs us to help the needy, it's on an individual basis,
sure,
not on a state-run basis.
And it presupposes private property, and it presupposes individual wealth and responsibility, you know, as far as, you know, having wealth and being wise steward of that wealth,
right,
to give.
To be able to give.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. We obviously have this montage of different isms that relate to our culture and that we're steeped in. And we have to address them, and we need to be informed, and we have to understand our own worldview. That's
yeah,
really
and make sure that, you know, you're comparing everything to Scripture, not just listening and accepting all the messages that are being given to us by politicians and by television.
Yes. What is that called? Neuro-linguistic programming. Yeah, look that up. That's scary stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, let's transition now to our main topic, which, we're getting into a series on food preservation, and that's really important. We're heading into that time of year. It's almost fall. We're approaching winter, and this is the time of the year that traditionally everybody needs to preserve their harvest, preserve their crops, their food, their meat,
mm-hmm,
and that's kind of what we're talking about today. That's kind of what we're going to get into. Of course, you can do a whole lot more than canned meat.
Yeah, but there's lots of ways to preserve. And so right now, I think just starting out with talking about canning.
Yeah, and again, we're going to do a continuation of this. We will get to dehydration and...
maybe even smoking.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get to those
fermenting.
Things. Fermentation, yeah, absolutely. Those are really good. Okay, so, you know, you just recently taught a workshop on canning. And it was a great success. Everybody really, really enjoyed it and learned a lot and are actually saying, okay, when's the next class, the next step, you know, the little bit more advanced.
Right, yeah, because this was a basic just sort of introduction for people who really had never done canning before.
Right.
Or hadn't done it in like 30 years.
Right, okay. And you've done this quite a bit. You've got some good experience canning and you're very knowledgeable with it. So how do you start with the person who has no idea? They've never done it, or they haven't done it in 30 years, so
has changed in 30 years in the canning process, so it is like starting over again. But one of the things that I definitely do is talk to people about the equipment.
Okay.
You know, what do you need? And because there's a lot of tools out there that really are really fun to have, but not necessary.
Okay, so then what are the essentials?
Okay, well, if you're going to be doing pressure canning, and canning anything that's...
Well, can we start with this? What is the difference between water bath canning and pressure canning?
Okay, well, the difference is that the water bath canning doesn't have to be at such a high temperature because you're doing acidic foods. So they can seal and be kept...
preserved?
Yes.
Okay.
Easier than something that's non-acidic or that's alkaline.
Okay.
So your meats, broths, vegetables need to be canned in the pressure canner.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I got you totally off
track. At a higher temperature. Yeah.
Okay, so the higher temperature inside the jar.
And it processes a little bit longer than water baths in general.
Okay. I'm sorry, I kicked you off track. You were talking about materials.
Yeah, so the pressure canner with a rack, and usually all the pressure canners come with a rack, and there are lots of different kinds of pressure canners.
Okay.
Now, you can spend all the way up to $300, or you can buy a basic one for $75. I have both one that I paid $75 for and one that I paid $125 for, and they're both equally functional.
Okay, so, you know, one of the things we always say is you can't afford to go cheap. Is this an area where you can't afford to go cheap, or is this an area where the lower-end models are just as effective?
Yes, but I would say that probably in this case, if you have the money, I would invest in an All-American.
Okay, so that's like the premier pressure canner?
It is, and it's got the, you know, the screw top, you place it on and put the bolts in place and tighten it up. That's what I would recommend if you have the money. If you don't, the $75 canner will do just as well. It's just probably going to need to have fixed pieces a little bit more than an All-American would.
Like the seal.
The seal and things are sometimes can come loose.
Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. That makes sense. So in this case, we want to take a look at the quality, but if we need to, we can start
right lower end. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I did. And this year, I bought a little bit more expensive to kind of show people the different ones. And I think next year, I'll be buying the All-American.
Okay.
For teaching purposes.
Of course.
Yeah. The other thing for a water bath is you have to have the water bath canner and a rack that goes inside. Those are real cheap, real easy to find almost anywhere, from drugstores to, you know, Walmart, home and farm stores. And then it gets down to the canning jars, lids, and rings. And there's a whole variety of those. I recommend when you're looking at jars to stick with the wide mouth if you can. Some of them, once they get too small size, there is no such thing as a wide mouth jar. But the wide mouth allows you to get the food in and out easier.
Okay.
And to wash the insides of the jar easier because you can fit your hand in. Some of those regular mouth jars, you can't even get your hand in.
Okay.
And then you would have a funnel to help you put the food into the jars. A jar lifter, which in our class, it was interesting. There was someone had used the jar lifter before, but it had used it the wrong direction.
Okay.
So she, where her hand
was... Does
that
become a disaster?
It can, yes. Okay. Because one side is curved and it's a rubber material that really clings to the can, while the other side is straight and it's plastic. So I was surprised that she didn't drop.
Okay. All right. So you use this to pull jars out that are obviously very hot.
Yes, very hot out of both, you know, both of the type of canners. And then you need some way to measure headspace in there, because different ones will need different headspace. I have a magnetic lid lifter and it's really fun.
Yeah.
And it really just only picks up one lid out of the boiling hot water right as you're canning. But you can use like tongs. It's not a necessary tool, but it's nice.
Okay. All right. So what would you estimate would be the cost of an initial setup for someone who says, okay, I really want to learn this skill. I want to be able to do water bath canning. I want to be able to do pressure canning for the various, you know, foods and the acidity and the alkalinity. What would be an average cost setup? I mean, how much can they invest and go, okay, I've got all the tools, the materials to
well,
start?
And that's going to depend on your pressure canner.
Okay.
So, but if you're going to get a, you know, just a mid-grade $125, then, you know, probably around less than $200.
Okay.
For all the tools. I'm not counting the canning jars, lids, and rings because...
Okay. All right. Obviously, that's going to depend.
Yeah.
Okay. But just getting the tools in place, a couple hundred, you could do it for a couple hundred bucks. Anywhere from $200 to $400.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So, so you take someone, you obviously broke out all the materials and showed them the different tools. Then where'd you go from there?
Well, we talked about jar sizes a little bit because those can be confusing. For our family, since we do have a large family,
right.
I generally will jar things that maybe some people would do in pint-sized jars. I'll do in a quart because we use it so quickly. If you have a family of two and there's only two of you at home, or you're going to give it as gifts, then you can select your smaller jars. There's some things like when you're canning meat, you want to be using that meat. So when you open it, you don't want to have 3 days worth of meat sitting in there. So for your size family, again, helping you determine.
All right. Makes sense. So you're going to, your packaging or your jars in this case is going to be dependent on the usage. So if you're, you know, you want to be able to use it all within a day or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you open it, it can sit in the refrigerator for a couple of days, but it's better just to use,
okay,
you know, especially things like meat,
okay,
and broth fairly quickly, whereas the jams and jellies and salsas and...
They could probably stay in the refrigerator for quite a while.
Yeah, those could stay in there for a week or two.
Okay, so we have our materials. We've right-sized the jars based on our family. Before you tell us the first step, what do you say to the woman? Because I know a lot of your students say this to, uh-huh, you. I'm afraid I'm going to kill my family if I enter into canning.
Yeah. Well, when I was talking to the ladies last workshop, I think every single one of them said that. Like, I'm afraid I'm going to do something wrong and I'm going to get everybody sick and we're going to end up in the hospital. If you're following the, you know, sterilization procedures and you're following the recipes, which are tested and made because all foods are different density, that the heat can go through at a different time, you're following the right gauge reading for, yeah, your pressure canner and processing it the right amount of time, you're going to be fine. It's not a complicated science. It's just a matter of following instructions and just doing
so
it how it says.
If you follow these procedures like you're talking about, there's probably very little chance you're going to get anybody sick.
Very little. Very, very little. And as a matter of fact,
probably
I would
less
say,
than, you know, regular commercial stuff.
Oh, definitely. I would say there's really no chance because you're so careful from the beginning all the way through to the testing to make sure, did the can seal correctly and everything, is everything done right before you even put it on the shelf?
Got it. Okay, I'm going to ask you a challenging question.
Okay.
What do you say to the woman who said, yeah, my grandma canned all this stuff and she didn't worry about all these gauge readings and pressure canners and she did all that and nobody got sick?
Yeah, nobody died. So yeah. Can't I do it that way? Well, I guess the answer would be that most of these recipes are made with extra safety precautions in place.
Okay.
So is there maybe some fudge to do it a little less carefully? Probably. But with all the advances we have and the knowledge that we have of bacteria that we didn't have a long, you know, 60 years ago when grandma was still canning with wax or whatever.
Right.
We may as well follow the policies and be as safe as possible for our family.
Okay. All right. So you're saying that recipes are they're conservative.
Yeah.
And we probably could get away with more, but why?
Exactly.
Okay.
And these really have been tested and they've, you know, kept them for long periods of time and then pulled the stuff out and tested for bacteria. These are tested recipes out there. Now, maybe not if you're going to a grandma's site, but.
Okay. Now you mentioned wax. What was that all about?
Well, I know at least growing up, I had a grandma who would seal the tops with wax. And generally this was jellies and jams. It wasn't meat or anything,
okay,
like that. But it was a form of water bath canning where they would literally pour wax on top and it would seal around the edge. Now, I think there was always a lot of mold and issues on the top little layer.
You just scrape it off.
I think they just scraped it off. I don't know, but
okay,
that would worry me today.
But nobody in your family died when you're...
Nobody in my family died.
Okay, so
but
grandma did fine.
Grandma did fine and everybody, but it's not a recommended...
Okay.
Way to keep,
all right,
today.
That makes sense. That makes sense. We're not, you know, and you find this a lot. You'll find yogurt recipes. You'll find all kinds of things like, oh, if you don't do this, you're going to die. Even though,
yeah,
people didn't, they didn't use those things before. But it doesn't mean we're going to die necessarily. But we need to. It makes sense, I guess, to follow enough, you know.
Yeah, you may as well be careful,
sure,
and
sure,
take those extra precautions.
Now, what is the bacteria? What is the threat? What is everyone afraid of getting?
Botulism.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what can you tell us about botulism as far as in the food?
Well, it is in the food. We have spores of botulism in all the food. And so as we process, we're bringing the heat up inside the glass jar.
Okay.
So that's killing, or at least slowing down majorly.
Not allowing the spores to develop.
To develop, yeah.
Okay, that's the reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, bacteria is always present. Same thing within
freezing,
you know, processing meat.
Or anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's important information because I think people get in their mind that, oh, well, I've already killed all that. I've killed everything. You know, like when you're in the
right.
freezer. Oh, I've killed everything. No, you actually haven't. You've slowed it down to a crawl. That's right. Why meat still goes bad in the freezer.
Right. And that's also why there is cooking procedures for meat as well, depending on what kind of meat you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, pork in particular, you want to make sure you're cooking fully through. We have all of these safety rules even after taking them out of a preservation place, whether it's a freezer or whatever.
Okay. All right. That's good information. All right. So then now that you have squashed the fear out of everyone, what's the first step?
Well, the first step is to check your equipment because you want to make sure that your pressure canner is reading the gauge is reading correctly, because that's an important piece of, you know, bringing it up to pressure. You want to make sure it seals fully. And you can tell that if you test it at all by bringing some water up to heat in there, and you'll see water dripping down the side if you've got a leak. And you don't want to be using that for water bath canning jars. Pressure canning jars. Secondly, you're going to be checking for any cracks or nicks or anything like that in your glass jars. Because under pressure or even in heat, they may just pop.
Okay. And is there any like jars that you shouldn't use?
Well, you shouldn't be using old mayonnaise jars, old jelly jars, all those things that you get from the grocery store where you bring them home. You're like, oh, it's a peanut butter jar. I'll just save that and can later. They do not recommend using those. First of all, they're not necessarily tempered the same as canning jars are.
Okay.
We don't know how the glass has been structured. And so it's safest to use jars that were intended for home canning purposes. And it'll have like Kerr or Ball or whatever on the jar itself.
Okay.
And you can find lots of those at secondhand stores. And those are okay to reuse. Just not, you know, jellies you got from the store.
Okay. All right. So then after you've checked all your equipment, now what?
Well, we just checked our jars.
Oh.
And we need to check our lids. We need to check our lids. Because when you use your lid, sometimes you have to pop it off with a can opener. And if you've got any dents or anything in that, it's not going to seal correctly. So you need to make sure you're using a perfectly round and unnicked, dented lid. And then other than that, I mean, those are really the most important things to check for your equipment to make sure it's all functional.
Okay, so now that the equipment is all set, what are some other considerations as you begin to can, whether it's water bath or pressure?
Okay, well, the first one that I talk to, especially people around here, because there's a lot of mountains in this area, is your altitude.
Okay.
Because with the pressure canning, your altitude will affect how high temperature the water is boiling at.
Okay.
So you need to adjust for your altitude, and the PSI will need to be higher.
Okay.
Yeah. The pressure. So the pressure gauge, like for us, the pressure gauge has to be at 15 if we're using weighted.
We're right around 2,700 feet.
Yes.
Okay.
And then it has to be between 11 and 12 on the dial gauge. For water bath canning, you will have to process longer if you're at a higher altitude than 1,000 feet.
Okay.
So those are things that you need to be aware of. What is your altitude? And so you can adjust these recipes just a little bit for your altitude.
Okay. That's an important consideration.
So the other thing that I would think about before getting started is how much are you going to can? How many jars will you need to fit into each one of your canners? So say you're trying to can a lot of meat in one day. Well, you may need to have two pressure canners going on then, because you can only fit a certain amount of jars, and each one of those pressure canners will be able to hold a different amount in different sizes. So it's important for you to know your own canner.
Okay. I mean, if you had a big harvest, you could spend a long time canning then, I guess.
Yes, which is why I have two water bath canners and I have three pressure canners.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and a fourth one coming out this next year. But that is why, because when I try and can a lot at one time.
Yeah,
and I just try and get it done.
Right. Okay. It makes sense.
And the other thing you have to think about, though, is that these pressure canners can take up a lot of space on the stove. So,
okay, good point.
You know, you may or may not be able to fit more than two pressure canners on your stove.
Okay. Now, you see the pictures on social media of like the hole in the roof or hole in the fan with the pressure canners. What's that all about?
Well, likely what happened is that they didn't make sure that it was sealed fully. Okay. You really need to make sure it's completely in place and not just like, oh, yeah, that's good enough. Or it's not shutting all the way, but I'm just going to leave it. Because one day I did have the water going and it just got too high of a temperature and I wasn't able to push the lid down hard enough to get it to lock in. So I took it off the stove right away, let it bring down to it's cool enough so I could lock it in place correctly. So that's important for people to be aware of. Don't go, well, that's good enough. And then not expect it to explode into your ceiling.
Yeah.
Because it will.
Yeah. Okay. That's really important.
Yeah.
You have to treat it like a firearm almost.
Yeah. Yes. Because it
is. Don't put your face over it.
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of steam can come out of that, the vent.
Okay. So burning is a factor as well.
Yep.
Okay. Good. So those are some considerations.
Mm-hmm.
Any other tips on, I know you're not going to walk us through a recipe.
Because no, but
each one's different.
Everyone is different, and using the water bath or using the pressure canner is going to be different. So, again, important to read the directions. But I will say, please don't forget to wipe the rims of the jars. I think so many people forget to do that, and I think that's part of the problem why people can't get things to seal. If there's oil or if there's sugary liquid or anything that has spilled on the top of that jar, that the rubber seal from the lid will not be able to attach to the jar correctly.
Okay.
So I use a little bit of vinegar water and just wipe the rim before I put on the lid.
Okay. All right. Any other tips as far as canning is concerned? Maybe afterwards? I mean, what do you do?
Oh, yeah. Afterwards. When you take the jars out, it's a magical moment. You're waiting for those jars to go pop, to show that they're actually sealing. And you can hear them and you can see them. And it's really tempting to start messing with them.
Okay.
Pick them up, dump it upside down just to see, oh, wow, look, I made jam. Don't touch your jars.
Okay.
Just leave the jars alone.
Take them out.
So you set them on probably a towel. That's what I do. So they don't get cold from the counter and then break because they're coming from very hot water onto a counter. But just leave them alone. Leave them alone until they're totally cooled, 8 to 12 hours. And generally, mine's overnight. I touch them the next morning, remove the rings.
Okay.
And then test to make sure.
Why do you do that? Why do you remove the rings?
Well, part of the reason why I do it right away is because I can use my thumb and try and pop any of those lids off.
Okay.
If those lids...
You don't go like really hard.
Not hard. But,
okay,
but
you're checking the seal.
You're checking the seal, but you know, even if you did it really hard, most of those jars seal so well that you have to use a can opener to get that lid off.
Okay.
So if you're able to pry it even in a kind of
just with
a hard way with a flick of your thumb,
it
did not seal.
Okay.
So I do that and I check to make sure all of them have popped down. There should be a little divot in the middle of each of those jars. And then storing them without the
rings?
The rings is actually a better way to store. It cuts down on rust or anything that would go around the outsides. And you can also tell then very quickly if the lid has come unsealed. The ring will sometimes hide that fact.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so having them out there and loose and being able to come off, and you go, oh, wow, that one, I must not have checked that one, or it unsealed or whatever.
Okay. You mentioned early on in this that one of the main, the main difference really between the water bath and pressure canning was the temperature that is achieved inside the jar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it something where you have to then check temperature in the pressure canners, or is it just pressure? What is?
It's just the pressure. And for the water bath, it's bringing it up to a rapid boil and keeping it at the boiling stage. In that case, you're going to have the water above the jars. In the pressure canner, you're only going to have a couple of inches of water.
Oh, okay.
But you're bringing the pressure and the heat up so high in the pressure canner that it's heating that food all the way through, including cooking it. You can easily raw pack chicken and cook that thing while you're processing it.
Wouldn't that be recommended then?
That is the best way to do it.
Okay. So whether you're chicken, rabbit, doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Raw packing.
Okay.
Yep.
And just because of the pressure, I'm just trying to understand this a little bit. Make sure I understand it. Because of the pressure, that's what allows the heat to get up much higher.
Correct.
So the idea is in the water bath canner cannot achieve those types of temperatures.
No, it can't. Okay. So you have to do...
So those botulism spores can still grow up potentially. in the water bath canner if you have an alkaline food.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the only difference is with the acidic food, botulism is not going to grow at the same rate. It can't grow. It's a hostile environment.
Got it.
Not a good environment.
Okay. All right. So what's an example of an alkaline food? What's an example of a acidic food?
Well, you can actually use the tomato as both, because you can can a tomato and it's an alkaline. It's right at the zero point, basically. But if you don't add any acid to it, you have to treat it as an alkaline food.
Okay.
So if you add lemon juice to it or lime juice in the form of salsa, if you add vinegar to it, if you're making a spaghetti sauce, all of that would be treated as an acidic food and can be water bath canned.
Okay. Okay. So there's some tricks to move the pH.
Yeah. Beans would be considered an alkaline food, you know, just green beans.
Yeah.
But if you decided to pickle them, suddenly they're an acid food.
Okay.
Because they're in vinegar now.
Gotcha.
So, you know, it's the presence of the acid. And if you have foods that don't have that much acid, then they need to be water bath canned.
Okay. Now, all meats require pressure canning?
All meats. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. I think you definitely covered all the basics for sure. Any other tips as far as canning is concerned?
I don't think so. The shelf life is really good.
Okay, yeah, great. Food preservation. Let's talk about that. I mean, as far as, you know, we have our freezers and we have our water bath and our pressure canners. How does one determine which technique to use?
The things that helps me is running out of freezer space.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we can't keep every single thing that we kill or we butcher in our freezers. It's not possible. We'd have too many animals and too little space.
Okay. That's a great consideration.
So that will help me determine how much meat am I going to can this year. The other thing is, how do you cook? Do you like to open a can of meat, of pre-canned meat, whether it's chicken breast that you bought from the store or tuna or maybe some stew meat or whatever, and just dump it into your casserole and have dinner quickly ready? If you do, then canning, it's a better idea because that's already ready. It's cooked for you and you just can pour it right into your ready-to-go recipe.
Got it. Okay. So what you make can determine this.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we don't ever want to have just one means of food preservation, namely a freezer.
Right. Because if we lose electricity, something goes wrong, that meat will...
For an extended period of time.
Yeah. It's not going to last very long.
Yeah. Now, what about someone says, well, I'm going to keep it in the freezer and if something goes bad, then I'll pressure can it.
That's going to be a lot of work very, very quickly.
So we need to think that through.
Yeah.
You know, you can probably do that to some degree.
Probably. I wouldn't want to have more than probably 25 pounds of meat that I want to preserve now in a jar.
Okay, so it's be unrealistic to have an entire chest freezer full of meat and go, oh, well.
I'll just can it. You're not going to be able to get that much canning done in the amount of time it'll take for that to defrost and go bad.
Got it. So
it's better to be prepared in advance. Plus, this is a skill that, to me, is invaluable. If you wait until you need it, you're not going to be able to do it.
Okay.
You're going to miss your opportunity. So be prepared in advance with the skills necessary, even if you don't sit around and make canning a new hobby, but you're doing it just to have this information and to get knowledgeable and to, okay, I can do it. I've pressure canned. I've water bath canned. I didn't really like it that much and our family doesn't use it that much, but I know how to do it when the time comes.
Okay.
If I need to.
Now, depending on the kind of meat, whether it's primal cuts, so roasts and things like that, or even down to, you know, cut up stew meat or even processed further, we have ground beef. Those things stored in the freezer have certain shelf lives. So your primal cuts will last a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, you know, 6 to 9 months, maybe even upwards of a year in the freezer and down to, say, ground meats that, you know,
last
maybe
about three, four months.
Yep. And that's if you have good packaging.
Yeah.
What about canning?
Canning, you know, meats will actually last a long time. Now, I think for optimum taste and optimum nutrition, you probably want to use it within a year. That's what I try and do, and that's what I would recommend. Maybe up to 2 years, but after that, I think the nutrition starts depleting enough where you're not going to get the same as you would have had you eaten it within the first year or so. But in an emergency, that stuff lasts for several years.
Okay. So yeah, survival food, emergency food, yes, it can last a long time.
Yes. And it's going to last longer than the freezer by far.
It's going to last longer than the freezer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because your meat will start freezer burning,
absolutely,
and start going bad.
Yeah.
Within a year.
Interestingly, that's because the bacteria still exists and lives even in the freezer.
Right.
Which is another misconception people have about the freezer. They think everything is dead.
Right.
It's
and
actually
it's not. It's just slowed down.
Yeah, to a crawl.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's excellent. So you recommend 1 year, you know, maybe up to two for mm-hmm. canned meats.
And well, especially if, you know, if everything is going well and you're canning
every
for your
year,
family
you're
just
harvesting
for menus. Yeah. And for your family's just menu and all of that. Rotate.
Yeah.
Please rotate. Rotate all your
within a year, right?
Canned stuff. You should constantly be rotating. Yeah. And if you make it, if you say, okay, I'll can every couple of months, whether it's meat or anything else, you'll always have that rotation going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great information.
One more thing that I forgot to mention. It's really important to make sure you date and label your jars. I do it with either masking tape or a small little white label. But this helps you to make sure that you're using them in the right order and having some sort of system in your pantry where maybe you're loading the newest from the back and then you're taking from the front, kind of like grocery stores do.
Okay, so you're facing.
Yeah, facing or whatever system works for you, but making sure that you're using the jars in the correct order.
Okay. And as far as dating is concerned, are you putting dates for when you canned or expiration or
when I canned?
Okay. So it's opposite obviously from grocery stores that come with an expiration date.
Right. I don't put an expiration date ever. I want to know when did I can this food and now, okay, I'm using it within 6 months. It's perfectly fine. If I'm using it within 3 years, I go, well, it might not taste that great, but it's still, you know, food.
Okay. Excellent.
Still calories.
Very good. How about next time? We're going to come back next time with some more food preservation.
Yeah, I think next time we'll try to cover dehydration and possibly curing, salting, and maybe
talk
even
a little bit more about the freezer.
Maybe talk about the freezer. Yeah.
Okay. All right. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.